I think they also just don't come and ask me when they're like, they want this and this. They're like, don't tell Zach. It's just going to crush him. Like, let's just tell them no, and we don't even have to tell them. We don't even have to tell Zach that they asked for it.
Yeah. I mean, the majority of our front of the house has been here since we opened. So, I mean, you spend 3 years, 5 days a week, 3 years of working with the same, not the same food, because the food changes all the time, but with the same people and hearing the stories and hearing why, you know, they're just, they're better able to communicate to the guests why, and that each dish is special and it's not a mistake why these two things or four things that are on the plate come together. It is all intentional. There's always a purpose. There's always a story. And after sitting through that many pre-shift meetings with Zach and myself and trying the food and talking about the food and tasting it with the wine that it should go with, I think it just, we have a team that really, really understands the why and the how behind everything. And they're great at telling those, passing on those stories to our guests.
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat. As always, I am your co-host, Matt Miller, culture editor at onmilwaukee.com. And I am joined, as always, by dining editor at onmilwaukee.com, Lori Frederick. How are you doing today, Lori?
I am doing great. I've had a full day already.
Yeah, we are recording on September 26th right now. We have run face first into fall. It is now 60 degrees at best outside. Yeah. I hate it.
It's amazing.
I love this weather.
No,
I can put a sweater on and there's still sun outside, I'm
fine with like 65 degree weather. But right now it's not 65 degrees. It's like 55 degrees. And that is cold. I'm in a house and I am cold now. And I'm frustrated with life. I like
you heat. Just need to adapt. See, and that's the thing about this time of year.
Lori, I've lived in this state for 32 years.
But every time the weather changes, like when it goes from being 60 degrees to 90 degrees, like in a pinch, which it does, you know, every now and again.
A slow roll would be nice.
That's a huge transition. And when it goes from, you know, 80 degrees to down to less than 60, it's always a
I'd be fine if we soft opened, you know, fall the seasons.
But I kind of don't care. I really love the fall, so I'm really happy when it just.
I think I look better in sweaters and jeans than I look in shorts and t-shirts. So I think you're probably right.
As most people from Wisconsin would agree, I think.
Yeah, they all have the same opinion like about my fashion. They all have very similar Matt Miller takes.
Scarves and hats and sweaters.
Yes. So
we have, as you may have been able to tell, we have guests on this podcast. Two of them.
Yes.
Lori, would you like to introduce them?
I would. And we have returning guests. We're here with Sarah and Chef Zach Baker from Kalu Kenzo. And we are here again with them because our first conversation was so rich and lovely that we really didn't finish. Like,
it's like a delicious ragu. It was flavorful and deep in flavor. Yeah. And they were guests so nice, we had to have them twice.
Yeah, we had so much background that we got through the last time, which was amazing, that we vowed to bring them back. And we have come through on that promise. So this is the episode in which we get to actually talk about food, mostly. You know,
which is great because I haven't eaten yet today. So this definitely isn't going to end with me just melting into a pile of hunger by the end.
So I will, in the accompanying text for this episode, I will link to the last episode where we really get into the nitty gritty of how Sarah and Zach both kind of came into the industry and ended up with their own Italian restaurant.
But now let's talk about that Italian restaurant, though.
Yeah. So let's... I think it makes sense the first place to start is where and why Italian fare? So obviously, like, there's a passion there that develops over time.
I think for me... because I don't know if Sarah wanted an Italian restaurant as much as Sarah just wanted a restaurant, I think, when I met her. But for me, the first chef that I kind of worked for who took an interest in me, who attempted to show me something, you know, beyond just whatever my duties and obligations were as like a salad maker or prep cook, he liked Italian food and had been to Italy. And this was like 1995, 96 in Door County where I lived. And he was like making risotto and gnocchi and had prosciutto and all these things that I had never heard of. And even for the dining public, at least in Door County at the time, risotto was a pretty far stretch, I think. Like nobody had seen that yet. You know, like we, like Food Network was in its infancy. And I think I just really liked that food. He made it. I tried it. I was like, this is amazing. So it was just kind of simple like that at first. Like I just liked the way it tasted. But as I read more about it and I started getting cookbooks and things of the sort, there's like a synergy of ingredients in Italian food and sort of like, there's almost like a regimented way of doing it. And I've never liked things that are kind of open-ended and you do whatever you want, you have whatever you want. Like I like the idea of like these sort of limitations and keeping things simple and not fussing over things. So the Italian food just kind of, it became my main focus in cooking. And I didn't have like long periods where I would dabble in like other cuisines. I don't really know anything about like Eastern and Asian food. Like I like to eat it, but I don't know how to really make any of it. Other than some Mexican food, like I haven't really even dove that deep on anything other than Italian, you know, food of our country, American, and just kind of where it comes from and kind of a little bit of French food here and there and stuff like that. But it was always Italian for some reason. The menus I wrote for my imaginary restaurant when I was a teenager were Italian. It was going to be like a fancy tasting menu thing, but that was just like a phase when I was young. I got over that real quick.
That classic tasting menu phase that we all have. We have dinosaur phase, just like Pokemon phase.
You come home from school and your parents are like, "Hey, Zach, we found this tasting menu under your bed. Is there anything you'd like to tell us?" Sort of thing.
I learned it from you.
Yeah. Maybe not the tasting menu. Maybe some other things. But so it was always Italian food, and it just, the more I read, the idea that the pigs that they made prosciutto from would eat the way from Parmigiano was kind of like this, like a perfect balance idea to me. And I just always like that there's some sort of story or reason why the classic dishes of Italian food exist. Like it's like geopolitical reasons or seasonality. It's like you can't untie it from the culture, and it just seemed fascinating to me.
Yeah,
absolutely. I agree with you about the kind of like, there is something to Italian food where there's lines to color in, and you can kind of do whatever you want within those lines, but it's kind of nice to not have the kind of like when you're given so many options and you can like freeze up, like it's kind of nice to be like, you have this play area to play in rather than being like, here's all of this space. And it can be overwhelming. It can be like, I need to be focused and I need to have, you know, I think there is something to Italian food in there. I think it's the kind of why people love baking too, is baking is like,
the narrow scope.
Very science, very breakdown, but you get to color within the science.
Well, I always say when you have everything, you have nothing.
Like,
like that.
Well,
it's the analysis paralysis kind of almost.
Totally. And at the same time, Italy is this kind of, because of the way Italy came to be as a country and the influences, you know, on the culture, like it's also fairly expansive. You know, I mean, because you have Northern Italy, which really, you know, takes cues from, you know, places like, I guess, Germany and Austria, and then you have the South and Sicily, which is mostly what we have in Milwaukee, you know, mm-hmm. which is just a completely, I mean, there's so much diversity in the cuisine, and yet I'm always, always impressed at how there are really like these tenets of the cuisine, like simple, use things that are close to you, you know, everything sort of comes together, and it's almost like the best practices that it's taken everybody else, you know,
yeah,
so long to get back to in the U.S., you know, like this idea of using local food, you know, and reducing waste and all of these things.
Yeah.
It's a hallmark of Italian cuisine. Part of Italian cuisine forever.
You know, not wasting things. You know, we always have some sort of dish that uses old focaccia. Not like old, but like, you know, from the day or two before, stuff that you're not going to just eat on as like table bread or something like that. They're very resourceful. And even with the limitations of Italian cuisine here, and again, like at this point, I think we sometimes just kind of do what we want at the same time. But I never feel stifled as a chef. Like, I feel like there's still so much that we haven't even thought of doing here yet that would still fit under the guise of what Kalu Kenzo's Italian food is. You know, and kind of going back to the locality of things, like you said, Sarah and I talked about our restaurant, you know, for years. And one of the things we always talked about was that to be a very Italian restaurant, not like you're going to serve the most authentic food or anything like that, but if you want to be the most Italian, A, you name it after something important, like dogs, and B, you use what's close to you. Like it would be more Italian to do things the way we do it, I think, than to just import every single ingredient under the sun from Italy, which we do get some because there's no counterpart. Like there's not good counterparts for like Pecorino Romano, at least like on a wide scale basis that I can get on a regular like clip.
Yeah, here. That's like I remember Tochi talked about that with their ramen way back in the day where they talked about, you know, all these cities and all these regions in Japan have their particular ramen flavors, and it's all based on that regionality. So when we made a Wisconsin ramen that had like brats and sauerkraut in it, that was more in the spirit of ramen than to, you know, try to make a, you know, make like a classic tonkotsu.
Totally.
Because it's like we are making a ramen from our area. We are representing what it represents.
Yeah. It was an evolution for us. I think, Sarah could testify to the fact that when she met me, I was like fundamentalist about the Italian food. Like wouldn't take any sort of like graces with it. It was always had to be this way or nothing at all. You know, this ingredient had to be this ingredient. Like I wouldn't dare sub anything or change anything. But gradually over time, the food we made at home started to resemble what we do here now, like this overarching umbrella of Italian cuisine. But we would find something cool at the market or something cool at the store. Or, I mean, sometimes you do an event and you have something left over that doesn't really have a home and that you didn't plan on having. And that's kind of like where the Kalu Kenzo food came from, was this, you know, reflection of how Sarah and I just like to eat at home when it was just the two of us. Italian, but with some liberties. Like, I've loosened up a little bit over the years.
I think it also helped that you went to so many different regions of Italy because you got to see essentially similar dishes, but made with very different ingredients. Like, the basis is all the same, but then you saw, okay, these people put this twist on it because this is what they have.
Yeah.
And I think that translates very well to what we have here, what we were able to source. I mean, our farmers are amazing. I mean, the season definitely isn't long enough, but when the season is happening, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Kind of even probably right now. Yeah. We're still in
I was telling tables a couple weeks ago that it feels like summer is coming to an end, and the first day of fall came real fast. It felt like for a while, like right when school started, that it was peak farm season. Like we had so much stuff coming in from our farmers. It was some days overwhelming. But super cool to see the pasta prep area just full of fresh peaches and tomatoes and zucchini and all the mushrooms.
Absolutely. And that, I totally lost my train of thought. But feel like this time of the year is always like, it's the best time of year to eat at any restaurant, but it probably for you guys is the most amazing time of year because all of the ingredients that are available, you know, I mean, including like tomatoes, are just like right there at the center.
Yeah. We have our two main farmers we get tomatoes from. From Amy's Acres and from Rare Earth Farm. And this year, to buttress it too, we also have some staff members who embarked upon a tomato growing operation in the backyard of our house, which Sarah and I live above the restaurant now, but we also have a house that not far from here that had a big backyard. And so we even have our own tomatoes here this year. Just more so, I have like staggered deliveries of them coming in more than anything. It's like I could get more, but they're not going to hold well enough for me to get a bunch at one time. I need to kind of stagger it out.
Well, and I was going to say, and I don't know that you need a pretty large kitchen to be able to, you know, process and hold a lot of that stuff. So you're probably doing this in the moment.
They kind of come in and then they leave. It's a weird time of the year, especially with the weather. I mean, it's September 26th right now, so when people are listening to this in a couple weeks, like, it just got cold out of nowhere, like we said, which I think is glorious. Matt does not agree.
One of us is correct.
But it's like, we have tomatoes and peppers and, like, the end of the sweet corn and fresh herbs and all this other stuff. But also, the farmers are like, what about some winter squash? I'm like, I can't. Like, I can't yet. Like, I'm like, it's again, like I do sometimes get a little caught up in like the form and the rules of things. I'm like, I can't serve like a butternut squash pasta and like a fresh tomato salad at the same time. Like, it's going to mess me up a little bit. It's just weird. Maybe I just need a dish where I can use them together, but I feel like that's again, like that might be a bridge too far for me at this point.
And that's so funny because I'm one of those people too where I like to hoard the season. I don't know.
Totally.
I like to push things really solidly into their seasons because then you can eat a whole bunch of it, you know, when and since squash keeps so well, like that's my fall and winter thing. Like I don't eat it until for sure we get the first hard frost, you know, because then it's like that's squash time. I don't know. But and I'm probably not like overly strict about that. But I can totally see, you know, it's kind of like make use of what you won't be able to get in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and like right you now. Said, squash keeps well. Like, I can hit squash and root vegetables and storage onions and stuff like that. Like, I could start them now, but if I start them in a month, they're not any worse. If not, they're probably better. So I really try to hold off that hard transition of the menu, you know, and try to get through these peppers and tomatoes and eggplant and stuff like that before we jump into that. Otherwise, again, like it's too disconnected to me and I start to feel.
I also feel like then you get sick of it because like storage vegetables and things that store well, you know, we're having to eat those like.
By March, I will wish that I had not started them when I did. Like, oh, if we just started these in January, you know, it does kind of wane by the end of it. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, like the farm lists show up and you just start getting you know, all kinds of stuff. And like the gears totally change again in the spring. And the farmers we work with have really been thinking about their, you know, businesses and how they do things. Because COVID was a big thing for them too, sometimes in good ways and sometimes in bad ways. COVID was good because suddenly everybody had all this time to stay home and eat, you know, produce from farms and take time and make things at home. So like CSA sales went up. But then at the same time, they have the same staffing issues, staffing pressures. Yes. And remember, like these places aren't in Milwaukee. They're not on a bus line. So it takes a special person to drive out to Belgium, Wisconsin, you know, 40 minutes every day to do farm work and then come back. So, you know, one of the things they're looking at is how to scale back but extend their season so they don't have so much work at one time. So it might be like starting stuff in a hoop house in like March and April. So a little bit earlier in the season, we can start having things like fava beans and like little radish, just, you know, anything to get the season going sooner than like June. You know, then in the same respect in the winter, they can use the same idea and grow, you know, like late season, cold, you know, cooler weather greens like radicchios and chicory, root vegetables. You know, it's shocking. Like, we'll get stuff from them until January normally, you know, and then it kind of starts up around April, May, very small amounts. But occasionally in March, they show up with like a case of spinach. I don't know. They get bored.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, they pause for a second in like January to do their taxes.
Yeah.
And then it's full speed ahead, you know, for farming and you're planning and
order stuff and plot out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about going to Italy. And I know that the two of you took a trip to Italy. I think it was a wine trip.
Yeah.
A number of years ago. Yeah.
We were also in Italy in 2009 at the Sarah met me at the tail end of one of my stages.
Which like parts of Italy did you go to?
So I've done three main stages in Italy and they were all a month long about. The first one I did was in 2006, right? Because it was before we were married. We were living together but not married. Scandalous. Well, that was in Umbria. Umbria is just to the east and southish of Tuscany, and kind of directly east of Rome. Umbria is like a landlocked region, doesn't have a coast, you know, has a bunch of like freshwater lakes and rivers and streams and whatnot, but kind of a forgotten region that a lot of people don't know about. Its food is kind of medieval leading in that way Tuscan cuisine is, like a lot of like central Italy is. But it was cool to go my first time somewhere that wasn't like, you know, Rome or Chianti or Venice or something like that, Milano. Yeah. Just because it was instantly like a different take. Like a lot of that other stuff, I can find that information and look that kind of stuff up. Umbrian food is like, there's not a lot you're going to like just stumble across on the internet unless you know exactly how to look for it. And there are weird words, weird dialects, stuff like that. So that was in 2006. I worked at a place called, it was a winery called Castello delle Regine, and they had a restaurant called Ristorante Portonovo. And it was like an agriturismo where they raise beef and grapes and some olives and stuff like that. They had a hotel and a restaurant and like a party event space kind of thing. So that was 2006. 2007, I went to the south. So most people know where Naples is, or if you, you know, it's easy to find on a map because it's kind of a big landmark in Italy. Inland from Naples is a valley called Irpinia, which is like where Avellino, like Oltrepalda, and stuff like that is. And I was in a little town called Nusco, which was like, it looked like this little like hill mountain in the middle of a valley. Like just like it wasn't even supposed to be there. And like the town was on top of it. It was kind of weird. And it was kind of treacherous to get up it with my bags because I, you know, anyways, I was on like a really small regional train to get there. It's like a speck on the map. It doesn't exist. And that place was weird because Umbria was very like old school and traditional. And so is Campania and Naples and Irpinia. But I was working this time at like a Michelin star place that did kind of tasting menu kind of stuff. But the chef, Antonio Pisaniello, was from that part of the world, and his food, while the textures and the form of things would be kind of like played with a little bit, like his flavors and his ingredient set were like an Irpinian grandma. Like he was still very steadfast in only using like the food of Irpinia, not Campania, not Naples, not Italy, like Irpinia. So that was a really cool experience and kind of, you know, like the Southern food in Italy is so rustic and so, in a way common to us here because a lot of the people who moved to America in the early, 20th century and stuff like that, like early 1900s, stuff like that, they were from the South, like they were from Naples or they were from Sicily. So a lot of the food here is not the same, but reflective of that food made with a different ingredient set. To be there and to see this food I recognize, but also another like interpretation of it, the other direction from what happened here. You know, like Pisaniello is the opposite of like the American Italian food. Like he went like the other hardcore, like creative fundamentalist way with European cuisine. It was just a very, I don't know. Like the food was very refined. It kind of opened my mind a little bit as to like what kind of bends the rules a little bit, but still totally respects like the source material, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just, I don't know. Like I felt like even more so than Umbria, I was like different when I came back from that experience. Like I felt, you know, like I was starting to kind of see this, you know, Italian food thing in a way that like maybe was different than a lot of like the other people that I worked with and or like other chefs I met in this country. Like I felt like I suddenly was getting an edge on things in terms of at least like how to think about Italian cuisine. And that was in 2007. I always affectionately referred to as my honeymoon. Sarah and I got married like a week before I went.
Not 4 days.
Yeah. I was walking. We would go to the cafe between lunch and dinner service, me and the other. There were like three or four other cooks who were staging there. One guy from the south, one guy from the north of Italy, and a guy from Japan. So we would hang out in the afternoons. I was the tallest one by a long shot. We would go to the cafes and stuff like that. We were walking back to our apartment one day, and they're like, they saw my wedding ring. They're like, oh, you're married. They're like, when did you get married? And I kind of like thought, I'm like, 10 days ago. And they're like, what? Like, are you serious? I'm like, you know, it's just, we kind of wanted to get it done then. There were some other reasons why we were going to get married in August, but we got married in March instead. It wasn't like I planned my trip knowing that I was going to bail a week after our wedding, but that's just kind of how it worked out.
Right.
But
well, if it makes you feel better, my husband Paul took exams the week after we got married.
Yeah, that's probably way worse
in college. And he was like we just, yeah. I mean, yeah. He was really close to graduating. And we were like, yeah. I don't know,
sort of
we
want to fall in a week and a half kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that was a month, 2007. And then my final stage was in, was it 2008 or 2009? Probably eight. Nine. Really? It was weird. Like, I'd been transferred to Lake Park, and these stages had all been set up under the guys that Urbieta, the chef of Ristorante Bartolotta, mm-hmm. was cool with me being gone a month because ultimately he's the one who's going to have to pick up the slack for me. But he was also the one setting these up for me. And then I get transferred to Lake Park, And I tell them, I'm like, my stage is October. Like it's in October. Like I'm like, I'll quit before I don't go. And then even then in late September, they're like, well, this isn't going to, how are we going to blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I don't know, man. That's not my problem anymore. Like I told you guys I was going to do this. I said, I'm not missing this. This is like the most important things to me right now. So with a heavy heart, I went to this time to Valpolicella, which is the Veneto, the closest main city being Verona. And I worked in the place that would probably most inform, you know, how Sarah and I, or like what Sarah and I were going to try to do eventually, in a way. That restaurant is still far smaller than what we run, but it was a restaurant run by a chef named Giorgio Suave, who, God, Giorgio's got to be just about 80 or something now. He's retired now. He actually sold the restaurant to another chef eventually. But Giorgio ran that restaurant. I think they opened in the late 80s or something like that with his wife. They had two daughters, Martina and Anna. And I think Martina was around like 13 or 14, but the mother had passed away. And Martina took over the dining room and was like the dining room captain, the somm, the server. So I get to this restaurant, and it's basically, they had some staff, but it was like a two-person operation, like Giorgio in the kitchen. Wow. And Martina running the dining room. And they were just in lockstep. It was like, I don't know, like it was small and romantic and like alluring, and like if you keep it all in front of you, you can kind of do things the way you want, as long as you don't, like, you know, let it get too big and involve too many people that you can't, you know, keep an eye on and stuff like that. And it really kind of cemented us having a place that would be smaller, like what we have, and something that we were going to work ourselves. You know, that it wasn't, we weren't going to be restaurant owners and hire a bunch of managers and chefs to do our jobs. Like, we were going to do it ourselves with our staff, not, you know, watch our staff do it. And they were just the sweetest people. And unlike my other stages, at the end of this one, another couple Sarah and I are friends with, and Sarah came and met me at the end of my stage. Sarah had never been to Italy. So the very first night they get there, the restaurant I was working at was actually closed that night because they had gone out of the country for a couple days to do like a press junket thing for the winery, the Palazzo della Torre people.
Cantanori?
No. Valpolicella.
Allegrini.
Yeah. They had done like an Allegrini press junket thing in like Switzerland or Sweden or something like that. So, which was cool because they're like, you're going to go to our friend's restaurant for a couple days. So I got to actually work at this other amazing place too with Ido Riolfi for a little bit, whose husband is like a revered winemaker in Italy. And they were closed, but I told them like, oh, my friends and my wife get into town, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, come have dinner. I'm like, well, you're not open. You don't have to open. They're like, no, we won't open. Like, just come and we'll make you dinner.
So Italian.
Yeah.
Yes.
But they're like, come and we'll make you dinner. But we weren't going to like sit down as a four top and eat. Like they had the big table in like, they had like a side staging room that was kind of like their family room. Like they ate at that table. They kind of staged things for service at that table. When they would give me something to eat, that's where they would tell me to sit down like during the service to try. And
the
so,
hearth was there.
Yeah. The like the fireplace hearth that we would warm all the bread and stuff up on was in there. So they make this meal. Giorgio's there. His daughters, Martina and Anna are there. I don't remember if they're, they weren't. They weren't with their now husbands now. Their friend, Giorgio's friend, Pietro, who was like a doctor in Verona, Sarah, myself, our two friends. And then the woman I was staying with, Lucia Ramondi, who ran the winery that I was staying at, which was like a little hike through the vineyards away from the restaurant. So I had this walk through the vineyards every day to get to. And they proceed
that
to make us.
That's terrible.
and treat us to like the meal you think about. Like when people are like, we crash landed in Italy and our friends with restaurants invited us for dinner. Like, I kind of thought it was always bullshit. Like, it didn't actually happen that way. It's like, this is ridiculous. Like, but like, we had this magical dinner that was maybe like the best time I ever had sitting at a dinner table ever, you know?
Oh, wow.
I'm not saying the food was the best or the wine was the best. I mean, it was all fantastic. But it was definitely the best time. And, you know, now over 10, 12, some years later, we still talk about it with our friends in like these sort of hushed, like, oh my God, do you remember the time?
What's the food at the table though? I have to know what was being served.
Giorgio kind of has like Giorgio dishes he does. So he had some house cured lardo and some soppressa, which is like the local soppressata salume that he knew somebody that made it. So he always had like the best charcuterie. We had some of that, some bread warmed up on the hearth. And then the main course, it wasn't like a super formal thing. It was kind of fancy style. They have a dish called risotto alla pilota, which risotto alla pilota, a pilota is, it's like the stone. It's like the stone at like a milling.
Okay.
Like a mill.
Because I think in Spanish, pelota is baseball. So I was just like, oh, really? Like meatballs? Oh, yeah. I think so.
There
I
was
could
no
be
baseball.
Wrong on that. I could be very embarrassing right now.
And risotto pelota is basically risotto. You add a little more liquid in larger doses. It's actually kind of just how I make risotto now, too. like the... The risotto we make here is kind of more reflective of Venetian, or not Venetian, like Veronese style. But it's just like risotto with a sausage that they call tasta sal, means taste of salt, because it wasn't made to be a fresh eating sausage. It was something that they would make a little bit of salami, but they would cook some to try it to see if it was seasoned enough before they'd pack it into casings and put away. It became an ingredient into its own right in the region. So tasta sal is like the sausage they use there.
So the test sausage becomes legitimate sausage.
Yeah. It becomes its own ingredient at that point. But again, it has a story. It has an origin, right?
Yeah.
So it was just a sausage risotto. The Parmigiano that was on top had a little bit of ground cinnamon in it too, which I thought was really interesting. Beautiful with the Valpolicella wines, the Amarone and the Ripasso. And then we had a cheese called Monte Veronese, which is like my favorite cheese, but kind of hard to hard to procure. I only know one place stateside that sells it, and they sell it at like New York retail prices, not something I could bring into a restaurant and actually attempt to do anything other than lose money on, because I know I'm going to eat like half of it. Like, I have to be able to make money on it. We had that, and then Giorgio always had the main dessert they would serve. They would have other things. You know, there was always a server who would come in, and every day she would bring like a fresh fruit crostata she would make. Like it would just change whatever she felt like making that day. And that's where I saw the idea of like whole tarts or cakes cut instead of making dainty little individual, you know, American fine dining things. That's what I was like, that's what we're going to do. Anyways, that's not what we had. But I just thought it was cool that they had it every day. Giorgio would make like a gelato sundae where he would take chestnuts that he would braise down in honey and hit with a shot of espresso at the end and pour that over the gelato, usually just like a plain, vanilla gelato.
So good.
Oh my God. It's like, we're going to do it here soon. Like I'm getting a freezer in the kitchen here so I can actually, we don't really mess around with ice creams or gelato or anything like that here yet. And then we had a lot of grappa. Cause Giorgio's friend Piero, the doctor, when I asked him to pass me the water, was like, you don't want water. Water's going to make you rusty. He's like, grappa. Something. So we were drinking espresso, and he was like, you'd rinse your espresso cup and pick up the crema that was stuck around the outside of the cup into the grappa, sort of like a Cafe Coretto, but grappa with a little coffee instead of the other way around. And that was the day I realized I like grappa. I don't know if Sarah liked it much the next day, but we had like this legendary meal that is still to this day is kind of like, if I could just replicate even a small percent of the feeling we had when people come into our restaurant, like I think that that would be really cool.
Well, that's the Italy. Like, I feel like everyone who goes to Italy has to come back with a story of going to like a person's house or to a tiny restaurant and getting like a meal just for them.
Yeah.
And like having this experience of not feeling like a customer at a restaurant or at an inn, but feeling like you are at this person's house as a guest.
Yeah.
And like sharing a night. And I do think that's something really beautiful about, you know, I mean, I don't think that's an exclusively Italy thing. I think that happens on, but it does feel very Italian in this kind of like, you come home with the strength, just like, yeah, it wasn't the best gnocchi I had, or it wasn't the best food I ever had, but you put all of the experience into it, and you put all of the story, like you were talking about, into it, and it becomes the greatest meal you've ever had. Like, the meal you speak about in reverent tones.
Yeah, totally.
Well, and in essence, that is what the goal is. I think, at least, like, from my perspective, like, that's the goal for any experience with food. Mm-hmm. You know, it usually has something to do with the food, you know?
Yeah.
And the food is usually well executed and lovely, but it's about the people and the place and the experience. And, like, I have had meals at restaurants that I will never, ever, ever forget. And they're so hard to describe to anyone. Because it was all about, you know, the air. And I don't know, you know, I mean, it was everything from the air to the people, to the conversations, to the, I don't know, the thing you did for the first time or the thing you realized while you were sitting there. I don't know.
Well, and I think
that's beautiful.
For us, I think I'm a pretty good cook. I think I can cook pretty good food. The staff I work with, I think are, you know, I'm lucky I have, you know, some, like, for me at least, like, I have like the most competent staff in the city I could ever hope for, just because they know I've worked with them a long time. And I think that, you know, in restaurants, especially chefs, they just think about the food, which, again, like, in the right circumstance, they should be free to do. That's their role in a restaurant. But I think too many places become so only about the food that some of the other things, like the general vibe, like the service or the atmosphere or the music, like, and it's kind of like you're saying about those great meals, like, you can't, it's not just like a specific thing, but there's this sum of all these little tiny things you can do that, you know, experiences like that in Italy for Sarah and I, have realized if we can try to do that as opposed to just, you know, making fancy food and kind of like standing on that, like, that if we can do everything like that, you know, cool after dinner drinks and, you know, little stories about things and service that are very personable and friendly, but in like a very genuine way, you know, it's just, I think those experiences in Italy for us is totally changed what we thought running a restaurant would be for us. Like, the goals became different after things like that.
Yeah. Well, I will say that you seem to be succeeding on some level, because just the other day, and I don't know if you saw this, but there was a post from a customer who recently went to Carlo Canzago for the first time and said, declared on Facebook. And a couple of people called him out. They're like, that's a big statement. And said that he went for dinner at Carlo Canzago and it was life changing.
This was a formal declaration.
But I also love reading that about places, you know, where I've been, where I sort of, you know, you can imagine how they would have that experience. And I can totally envision, you know, I mean, you guys do a really great job of pulling those things together, you know, what is just like the feel of the place, the people. So anyway, but I did also want to pass that along because, that's awesome. You know, you probably don't that see, is. You know, people tend to see the remarks like, you know, it, and I think a lot of times it's the complaints or the not mean, quite theirs.
we're not immune to it, you know. I will occasionally spin through like a review site, whether it be Yelp or Google or something like that. And honestly, it's almost all positive for us, which is wonderful, right? Like, people like it. That's what you want. We do get some flack from people, but I think that we serve, or we like what we do here is just not like a lot of restaurants that when you tell you're going to an Italian restaurant by your friends or your family, and then you walk in here, like, if you have a preconceived idea of what you were going to eat, like, you're probably going to have to like backpedal a little bit at that point.
If just you're because an Olive Garden don't serve, regular,
again, like, there's a million restaurants serving that same cuisine, like the same menu. And just from a business standpoint, why would I want to instantly wade in with a million other competitors? You know, like, we always were going to do like our own thing, you know? But the reviews we get, I think, that aren't favorable are usually you can trace it back to some sort of, you know, like they get kind of defensive or like you can I almost feel bad sometimes because I'm like, they came in, they had this idea of what it was. It wasn't that at all. And sometimes it's hard to recover from that. Like, these aren't people who are like mad at us. So we can tell
them. Expectation matters.
Yeah. And it's just that some of them are just people who, for lack of better terms, they're just cheap. You know, like, they don't understand why things cost what they do or why we don't give the bread away for free. Which I'm happy to have that conversation with anybody, but I don't think they're going to allow them to listen to me after the first minute or two.
Well, I think you get specific customers because, one, you are small and you really need a reservation.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have some room for walk-ins at the bar and such, but by and large, there is an anticipation factor. and you have people who are intentional. You know, if somebody can make a reservation and actually keep that reservation, there's a different sort of commitment to that sort of restaurant experience than you get, you know, just popping into a place and maybe having a so-so experience. You guys can also plan a little bit better with reservations.
Totally. I think something that can trip people up sometimes with us is we are a very small place. We don't do a lot of covers. We have very specific amounts of each item. And I think when people come, and we're pretty strict with this is our menu and this is what the menu has to be. If you have some sort of dietary restriction, of course, you know, we're not going to give you nuts if you are allergic to nuts. But we're also not going to change what sauce goes on what pasta. Like, it's, if the boar ragu comes with the pappardelle, the boar ragu is only coming with the pappardelle. So I think sometimes when people come in and they want to like create their own adventure, that can be challenging for us and for them. And with our menu changing so much, you know, what we always tell people, like, you may be really disappointed that you can't get what you had 3 months ago when you were here, but what you have today is going to be just as good, if not better, than what you had 3 months ago. But I think there's some people who just, they don't want to get out of that comfort zone. They want their pappardelle with more ragu every single time they come in.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why McDonald's and Olive Garden and TGI Fridays are the most famous restaurants in America. It's because Lori says this all the time. it's regular. They yeah. know that their dish is going to be there. They know that the thing that they always yeah. order is going to be on the menu yeah. no matter what. And it's probably right, going to taste the same.
Yeah. We like to be in our ruts and have yeah. our favorite things and not have surprises.
People totally. Like the routine with their eating sometimes, totally. But I think, yeah, there's that. Does that changed at all with the pandemic? Have you noticed customers being more kind of like, no, I'm here for an experience rather than a create your own kind of thing? Because I know the pandemic has really, in many ways, kind of changed mindsets and behaviors of customers. Or have you noticed any change at all?
I don't know. We've always been pretty strict about it. So I don't know if people are actually just asking less because now they're just coming for the experience, or they're just like, okay, this is how this place is. Or maybe our servers have just gotten better at their sales pitches to make people not think they wanted to create their own adventure.
I think they also just don't come and ask me when they're like, they want this and this. They're like, don't tell Zach. It's just going to crush him. Like, let's just tell them no, and we don't even have to tell them. We don't even have to tell Zach that they asked for it.
Yeah. I mean, the majority of our front of the house has been here since we opened. So, I mean, you spend 3 years, 5 days a week, 3 years of working with the same, not the same food, because the food changes all the time, but with the same people and hearing the stories and hearing why, you know, they're better able to communicate to the guests why, and that each dish is special and it's not a mistake why these two things or four things that are on the plate come together. It is all intentional. There's always a purpose. There's always a story. And after sitting through that many pre-shift meetings with Zach and myself and trying the food and talking about the food and tasting it with the wine that it should go with, I think it just, we have a team that really, really understands the why and the how behind everything. And they're great at telling those, passing on those stories to our guests. And
because those stories are essential. Yeah. Yes, like absolutely. You were saying, the meal in Italy, like so much of what made that meal important was that, you know, everything had a story, everything had a connection, everything. It wasn't just food. It felt like there was a narrative almost being told. Not in a highfalutin, you know, our meal today mm-hmm. will tell a story, but in that, you know, there seemed to be, you know, a reason and a backdrop for everything. Totally. And so if you have a wait staff that can pass that story along, that's essential. Yeah.
And I think their ability to get the whole order, like, I'm sure we've all been at meals where you like, okay, you decide on your appetizer and then you eat your appetizer and then you have to think about what you're having next. And then you have to wait for a while. And our team's really skilled at getting the whole order. So you can truly just, you have that one moment that you have to make these decisions. And then it's all just like this beautiful show that continues to come out in front of you.
And like, the food just keeps coming.
And it's amazing. And all these flavors and textures, and you can focus on your guests or the food or the wine or whatever you want to focus on in that moment. And it's just, I think, a really special experience.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lori.
No, please go first.
I was just going to ask, are there any dishes that you like love putting on the menu and that you're like, we cannot wait to get this one in front of people?
To preface that question, I think one of the things that I've always loved about Calle Canto is you will absolutely find things on the menu that you can't find elsewhere.
Like an ingredient or a preparation?
Typically a preparation. So I always think about the Sardinian gnocchi.
The Malorino.
I think that was on, on your opening menu. Mm-hmm. And how it was gnocchi, but it was like no other gnocchi I've ever had. And definitely not a gnocchi I'm going to find, you know, in the restaurant. And so I'm sort of dovetailing with Matt's question. Are things like that, you know, the joy of bringing people something new like that, is that part of it? Or what kinds of dishes
I think we know what you're asking.
I don't know.
No, yeah. Totally.
I think you, maybe you're saying makes sense. My drift. Yeah. Yeah.
I know there's dishes that I'm excited for Zach to put on the menu every year, and our team is too, but do you want to say what your stuff is first?
Well, I think the things I'm excited to put on the menu is, first of all, like you mentioned, the Malaredu, right? The Sardinian gnocchi, which, while we don't have a static menu, that dish is one that will come back from time to time. So we have like this at this point now, like a fairly vast repertoire of dishes that can kind of come and go. Something like Malaredu doesn't have a specific season. Like I can kind of like justify serving it almost any time of the year. But there's other things that are built around like an ingredient. Like right now we have like griddled shishitos and tropea onions with like a little walnut pesto and some really good like balsamico di Modena, right? And which honestly was just like a random thing we slapped together because we needed an extra app the first summer we were open, or like more like fall, because again, like it's shishito peppers and tropea onions. Like this is when we have them right now. And if I go back and I look at the menus for late September and October from 2021 and 2020 and 2019, that dish pops back up like every year. So there's excitement in that way for me, like when I know like a relied upon like crowd pleaser, we like making it, we like serving it, the customers love enjoying it, it goes great with wine. Like I get excited when I know that's going to happen. But I also, you know, like it's not like we only make things we've made before, or we try not to, you know, like I don't think that something that I come up with or introduce new to us is inherently better than the other things just because it's new. But there is an excitement to it when you can have something that you haven't done before. And you, I kind of refer to it, like I'll look at Sarah and I'll look at my brother who, you know, are kind of like my Italian food dorks on the staff with me. I'm like, you know what? This is the first time we've done this preparation here. Like, this is like one of the classics. And how did we wait this long to do this? I'm surprised we haven't, you know, like circled back around or like thought of this before. Like Balanzoni, like we have mortadella filled Balanzoni. It's like a classic bolognese pasta. And it's like one of those things that's like, it was always there. Like I always knew about it, but for some reason, like it just, you know, sometimes it's just, it takes one person saying something to me, like somebody on staff or a customer, or something flashes across like my phone screen or computer screen. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. And if it seems like something that suits what we do here or could be refined or maybe even like dumbed down a little bit to be what we would do here, that's exciting. You know, I don't have specific things anymore that I get more excited about than other things with food. It's just so broad, and to have a favorite is like, I don't know. It's like what month is it? Like, what did I have yesterday? Like, that's, then maybe I could tell you my favorite today, would be, but the food here, we just, I'm trying to think, like, I'm excited for truffle season. By the end of it, I don't despise them, but like, I'm done cleaning them and weighing them and stressing about like if I'm going to sell them or if I'm going to have to like put some in honey. And then like, you don't, I don't know if losing money is the right way, but you don't really make money on it then. And it's just, you know, because it's kind of like they're risky to bring in. They're risky to bring in, but I probably also like them because they're kind of risky to bring in. And I know the reasons why restaurants don't want to order a pound and a half of white truffles at a time. Like, because it's considerable risk. You're fronting a bunch of money for something that you then have to hope you sell and that you also don't eat yourself. So many that you don't make money on it. It's like other things, turns out. And stuff like that, that I know that we can do, that not necessarily is something that other restaurants would feel comfortable attempting or aren't going to be able to do on the same scale we do. Like, I get excited about that because I know that we have this thing that is not represented anywhere, save for maybe like another place. Like, I bet Adam down at Lupe and Iris is going to have truffles. You know, Juan's probably going to have truffles. But like, who else is going to bring them in and just give you more than a couple slices on something on a special for a weekend? Like, you can't just roll in and get like a tagine buried with white truffles on a Tuesday at a lot of restaurants.
Yeah, and a fresh truffle, a dish with fresh truffle, is worlds different than the truffle oil that
we've never even had a drop of truffle oil here.
Yeah,
like we've never had a drop. Like, I refuse to use it. One, it gives people the wrong idea about truffles.
Yes.
They're far more delicate and complex, I think, than truffle oil conveys. Mm-hmm. Truffle oil is like kind of a punch you in the face sort of experience with truffles, and that's not at all.
Yeah. Well, and so much of it is of it is chemically derived that you don't know really what you're getting when you go to a place. See truffle oil, I tend to run the other way.
I mean, it was cool for a minute. I mean, in the 90s, I know I bought a bottle and I put that shit on everything, man. Fucking mashed potatoes and scrambled eggs.
Red hot.
Like anything. It's like, maybe it's better with truffle oil. That's probably why I don't like it.
I think we all cured ourselves of truffle oil when it was all the rage because it was like everybody was doing truffle oil and it was like, oh, I need to buy some of that. And then, anyway.
But I get excited for new stuff. I have... Yeah. I only ordered one of them because I'd never ordered them. There's a company out of Texas called Broken Arrow Ranch. That's like they have wild game. It's on like the boar, I think comes from like a preserve, but it's not like ranch boar. It's like wild boar. Like they go around and they do boar things, root around,
boar things,
dig stuff up, eat roots and whatever they can find. Like, but I think because they're on a preserve, they're also not going to get in like somebody's dumpster, they're not going to like scavenge some nasty stuff. So, I've always used, their grinds and like thick, like muscle meats for braising and pate and sausage and stuff like that. But I ordered a rack, just one of them. And I think it's going to be about 4 orders worth but I never ordered one. So I didn't want to buy 10 of them and be like, oh shit. Like this is really, it's like $35 a pound.
Right.
Like, but I'm really excited to do something with those 4 orders this week. And because of the format of restaurant we are, on Wednesday or whatever day this week, when I get around to it, I can run 4 orders of a boar chop. It's probably going to sell. And then I can kind of have a better idea, like, what's possible with that product. Stuff like that's exciting to me. I've always known it existed, but just haven't had the chance to get around to bringing it in. Like, something like that to kind of work through the kinks and find a way to make something that people are going to like, that's also something we're going to be proud of, that also, from an economic sense, doesn't hurt us to sell, I don't know, that's exciting for me when I can figure stuff like that out too. Like the idea that we can have something that other places, whether it be truffles or like game, like again, like we're not like a super, we're not the most expensive restaurant, but I know we're probably on the higher end of a lot of it. It's just very cool to have the kind of customer base that comes in and trusts us to say, hey, we have this wild boar rack. Like, there's already customers on queue for us to call this week when we have it. Like, they know we have them. They know it's coming at some point. I couldn't tell them when, but they're like, call us. We're coming in that night no matter what. It's cool, but I like working through the kinks with stuff like that, too, and kind of trying something new.
And Sarah, you were saying before that there's certain things that you guys look forward to presenting to people, like kind of on your side.
Yeah, our team gets really excited about things. We are like days or weeks away from the carrot salad. Oh man, that carrot salad is so good. We just had the panzanella. I Now it's with watermelon. Oh, so delicious. There's this baked onion and focaccia and Gruyere cheese that's kind of like a French onion soup without the soup. I mean, there's just truffle season, of course, is always fun. But yeah, there's things that the staff definitely gets excited about. We just had a niçoise salad, like middle of summer, and that was around for only maybe five shifts, maybe less. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's fun for everybody when stuff that we love comes back, and I think it helps that it's only around for a few days. So if you're lucky enough to be here on the day that it's here and you get it, you're going to have to wait another 365 days to have it again, which is sad, but also amazing.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a lot about delicious food, but we should probably make sure people know where they can find it. So where can people find the restaurant?
We are located just on the last block of Wauwatosa to the east, so 60th and North Avenue.
Or 61st.
Yeah. Between 60th and 61st on the corner. A lot of people don't seem to know that parking lot is ours. Yes. So,
well, and in the world of restaurants and in Milwaukee, parking lots are a super exciting thing.
Yes, this is true. And I should note, virtually, where can people find you as well?
Yeah.
KaluKenzo.com. We're also on Instagram. We're not on Facebook. If you see us on Facebook, it's not us.
It gets to be too much busy work for restaurants to have all of these avenues of contact now.
Yeah.
You know, emails, online reservations, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I mean, it's like you can't do your job anymore.
In a lot of cases, unless you have somebody who's dedicated to that and can get really creative, you end up just sort of doing the same thing on all the channels anyway. Yeah. So you might as well just take advantage, you know. Yeah. I really don't mind it when places are easier to find, you know, and you can find everything all in one place.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or a couple of places. Because, you know, you think about it and it's like, well, did they post that on Facebook? Did they post that on Instagram?
Yeah. Where did I see that?
Where did I see that? Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But basically, yeah. So, but folks should definitely, I mean, if a person has not gone to KaluKenzo, I mean, I feel like it's one of those things that should be on.
You made a verbal disappointment sound, Lori. You made
If you haven't been, I mean, you'd have to put it on the list for so many reasons. And I feel like if you listen to this episode and the last episode, it probably gives you a ton of reasons better than the ones I would think of.
It's made me hella hungry,
right?
I'll tell you. I'm going to the fridge immediately after we're done recording, and I'm heating up some food just for the sake of...
So, something with olives again?
And we were just talking about wow.
No, actually, I made dinner for myself yesterday during the Packer game. I made a tasty chorizo and potato stew.
Nice.
For the second time.
For the second time, third time, technically. The first time.
All right.
It's more of a soup than a stew, which I feel like now that I've braced myself for that, I like it more. But yeah, so I'm gonna eat that and hopefully not give myself food poisoning. It's going great.
Yeah. So,
Lori, I'm doing so well at not killing myself with food.
Because it's harder to kill yourself. I mean, people will have you believe.
I don't know. You haven't tried my cookies.
It's harder than they make
it sound.
You have
a refrigerator, but it is harder to kill yourself with food than some people would have you believe.
You say that, but if you tried any of my dishes, it's a lot more plausible.
The FDA is going to swoop in on us any moment.
I was going to say FDA. Yeah, I was going to say. The FDA would like people. The Food and Drug Administration of America would like you to know that killing yourself with food is very possible.
Yeah.
But thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for what you do. For the city and for the restaurant community and for what you've done to this past hour of conversation and made me very, very... I really want to go to Italy now. God damn it.
I think we're going in the spring.
I think so.
Well, Yeah. Someone's in Italy, taking all your Hawaii stuff convention. Out of your blue suitcase and packing himself inside of it.
Yes. So basically,
we would be a good hang in Italy. I think.
Yeah.
I think I'd be a great hang in Italy. I think I would too. There's only one way to find out.
Yeah. It's true.
I'll try olives in Italy. Yeah. You know,
they're better there.
Yeah, because it's the phrase "when in Rome."
Exactly.
I do like that about you, Matt. Like you're kind of a never say never sort.
I am inspired by Justin Bieber. Right. You're right. Yeah.
No, that's not what I was thinking. But anyway, just to close this out, because we talked about wild boar, I did want to throw in a really bad joke.
And that
Well, and now the anticipation will destroy it. But like Kyle Kenzo, definitely never boring.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Cut the podcast off. Right.
Anyway, yeah, we can end now.
A really quick anecdote about boar. When I worked in Umbria, one of the issues at the winery was that the boar would come and they would be eating the Sangiovese grapes all the time. And we had a boar on the menu that we would braise in Sangiovese, and we called it Livia's Revenge. Livia being the owner of the estate. It was our way of trying to even the score. It's like, oh, you like that Sangiovese, huh? How would you like to be simmered to death in it?
How would you like to be braised in it?
You probably taste of it already.
So yeah. The chef would say they were marinated from the inside.
Hey, you know, maybe there's a cooking technique there. Maybe we're onto something.
Yeah.
The boar have terroir.
Some proto seasoning. It's like you just feed your animal, your boar, whatever you want it to taste like when you butcher it.
I think this is good. I think this is a good idea. I think we should run with it.
Yeah.
Definitely. No, seriously, thank you both.
Well, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Pleasure doing it.
Call the podcast. What an awesome conversation. They are delightful guests with an even more delightful restaurant. And now, best of all, I have... Sorry for the squeaking. My dog is playing. and now, I have a delightful bowl of potato and chorizo soup, which is very tasty. And it was interesting. You had told me, like, oh, it probably even tastes better the next day. Yes. And it was interesting. So, Jay Kenji Lopez Alt, person who's like basically got me into cooking, he was talking about the concept of things tasting better the next day, and he said that he did a test. Like he did a test where he gave people stew that he made that day, and then stew that he had made the previous day. And in his studies, they couldn't tell any difference. There was no difference in the quality.
Which is fascinating.
Which is interesting.
Because,
yeah.
But I don't think that sort of test makes sense in some fashion. Because...
But isn't the theory that you're testing that, like, the more time it has, you know... cool and hang out and the ingredients get to marinate a little bit more that the food tastes better the next day as a result.
Yeah. But, and I don't think it's true for every single food, but some dishes absolutely like just need time for things to marry. And I think dishes can be constructed in a way where the cooking process gives them enough time to marry, where it won't make a difference. So something like stew, which typically is long... I mean, a stew done right, like a beef stew, is long simmering. Those ingredients have had a long time together in the first place. So I'm not sure, like, that's the most...
Yeah, but I mean, that's... Like, but that's the... I mean...
I don't know. I mean, I just... His theory is that
when you're cooking food, your senses are already primed. Like, you've been surrounded by good scents and, like, the stuff cooking that you know, when you taste it, your senses aren't like getting reawakened. Like you've already been smelling the stuff. Whereas the next day, since you're kind of eating it fresh, like probably
for the first
like,
time, without for the first all time, the,
it's like yeah. such a shot to the senses.
Yeah.
That well, that's and why there, it seems probably, like it's better.
Yeah. That is probably to some extent true. But
it wouldn't explain like when I have my dad's chili, like, and I like stop by the house, like I haven't been there for the whole cooking process. So right. I'm not as primed as like he would be. So right. I don't know. It's all it's all very fascinating. It all is totally tangential to what we're supposed to be doing here, which is reading a food porn.
It's true. So, and this food porn is based on pasta.
Ooh, can't imagine why we'd be doing that.
I couldn't find it. I think if you remember correctly, I couldn't find a pasta poem or
which is weird because I would imagine that like there's so many fun words poets, to use.
What I'm learning about this though is that poets like things that are, you know, I mean, poets are poets and they like a lot of metaphors and so very simple things, you know, like pasta don't get, you know, the big crud. Like, I think maybe there's some good food writing out there that glorifies like fresh pasta.
Yeah, there should be. I don't know. There should be. Are you reading this one or am I this week?
So I don't know.
I can read this one.
All right. So this is sort of a I think you'll like this one. It is definitely a play on words.
I'm seeing a lot of puns, so this is a lot of fun. This is Remembrance of Things Pasta by Brian Bilston.
Yes, exactly.
And if you're thinking Remembrance of Things Past, Remembrance of Things Pasta, I think we're gonna have fun here today, Lori.
Indeed.
All right. This is Remembrance of Things Pasta. She blew her fusilli, my pretty penny, when she found me watching daytime tagliatelle. Je ne spaghetti rien, I responded in song, but she did not linguini for long, just walked out without further retort. A hard lesson to be tortellini, or so I thought. And so here I am, on my macaroni, and now my days feel cannelloni. What a fun poem.
Just
what a
clever. Fun poem. Just fun. Yeah, no, like not deep at all.
Don't know what you're talking about. I learned a lot about people blowing their fusilli.
Yes, yes. And pretty penis. Yes.
Yeah. Her pretty penny. Lori, where can people find more about you on the internet?
About me? You don't want to do that. I'm just kidding.
For the sake of this closing, Lori, I need it.
Yeah, I don't know. You can find more of me at Low Frederick on your typical social channels, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Yeah. Because unlike restaurants who have the choice of paring down to one, which I would love to do, I have to be all of those places. And how about you, Matt?
I am on Facebook and on Twitter at A Man About Film. I'm also at Instagram at those places, but frankly, am I really? My workplace is working really hard for me to get more on Instagram. I just don't like it. I don't like Instagram. It's too much effort, you know? I like my social mediums to be like my diary where it's like I can put in like the whole idea of like, oh, you have to do Instagram right or wrong. And there's like certain ways of editing that everybody does. And that's why things are worthwhile and get liked.
Yeah. Facebook's the same way, though. I mean,
I don't know.
Twitter's about the most conversational sort of medium. Yeah. Like where...
But the conversations are all bad, so...
Well, the conversations tend to be... I don't know. Not necessarily all bad. It depends.
No, they're not all bad. They're definitely not all good. Can people find more Food Crush podcasts?
And you can find Food Crush at Food Crush Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Well, perfect. Well, I'm going to eat more of this delicious soup, but I'm going to let our listeners... enjoy the rest of their day. Thank you to Lori. Thank you to our wonderful guests. And most importantly, thank you everybody listening. You all rule. And we'll see you next time, or hear you next time on the Food Crush Podcast, which, as always, tells you...
We'll converse with you again.
We'll converse with you again in the next episode, where, of course, we will keep cooking.